This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Be talking this evening in general about, let's say, about Olson, or describing a period where Olson will be a central figure. But to open up, keeping in mind what one can ferret out of this volume of Donald Allen's, where if you look at people's biographies, you could get somewhat a picture of the history. I'm going to try to give you some kind of my picture, not my picture corrected. I very carefully didn't go over biographies and try to find out what was the truth, because I'm sort of a living specimen, and my misconceptions about what happened 15 years ago are part of what I am, very definitely. So I'm going to try to give you an imprint of how I would tell a story of what was Charles Olson's background. If I began in the very beginning, it would be when I first met Charles Olson, which was in 1946. And at that time, our conversation consisted entirely of, we had two or three afternoons in Berkeley. He had looked me up because he had read medieval scenes that had just been written, and I did not know that this man wanted to be a poet. At that time, he had written poems, but they weren't of the kind that Charles Olson approves. One of them has even gotten into Atlantic Monthly, a place where I have never been caught in my life. And he had written Coleman Ishmael, but he was on work on and he was doing research on a second book. He was going to write a book on the Donner Party. But all I knew when this giant, he was 6'8", descended upon me, was that this man was a poet. Feels very good, you know, when a man's interested in your poetry. But then we talked about ecology. Actually, we talked about cities and farms, and how this was a subject that I was filled with at the time, because it seemed to me a vital thing that had happened in history, that I was thinking of in the Middle Ages, how as the cities grew, they had nothing to offer in return to the farmlands around them, and they had to be fed from the farmlands. And of course, even a vague impression of the Middle Ages gives you the picture of what happened. One thing they could do is protect farmlands around them. That is, it was the same method of protection and threat that holds our states together today. It was never very clear to a farmer in the Middle Ages whether he was threatened or protected by his immediate barons, at the same time, if the barons were very happily at war, it's a little different from our time, because if they were very happily at war someplace else, the farmer got along all right, but then he always had to supply the food for all this, and no one was returning him anything but protection. Then the main little thing that could come up in the capitalist system is a lovely combination of the commodity and advertising, and the farmer was convinced that he really needed a refrigerator so badly that his life was not fit to live without an automobile, and so he started working that long working day and putting it out and producing more food than he'd ever produced, than the whole farm world had ever produced before, to feed those cities and feed the people who were making automobiles. This was the talk we had. We may even circle around later and even make it likely this had something to do with poetry. Then an article appeared in a magazine. As a matter of fact, my impression was so terrific of this man, but it was so very definite that I didn't connect him with his being interested in poetry directly. We didn't talk about poetry at all in 1945. So in 1950, when Projective first appeared, I did not really recognize that this Charles Olson was this Charles Olson that I had found so wonderful 5 years before, and I had 4 years before, it was 46. I had not really seen it. I'd seen nothing of him. He was someplace off. He was in Gloucester or whatever. But the Projective first we read avidly, and we totally misunderstood it. Now, all of you have been reading projective birth, and I thought maybe you would like to know what, in 1950, I thought projective birth was about. Since we read poems aloud everywhere, and we were beginning to have audiences for the reading of poetry aloud, I read projective birth. I felt very enthusiastic about it. I thought it said that if you're reading poems aloud to people, that you're right in on the ground floor, and that this is the whole thing. And in general, I got a vague idea. Well, perhaps I thought the field was all of you out there, and you project, project poems. I felt that I understood every word of it, and yet, as time goes by, they say, in almost any subsequent reading, and that would mean any reading that I've done this year, I've always found been nudged over in between time, keeping the ideas of that essay alive, nudged over into a view that I say, well, what did I make out of it last time? How come I had that view? So, to go back to my initial remarks, that my misinformation will be, that you'll be sitting in on history, misinformation about an essay like projective verse or like about an essay like the human universe, I myself have to sit in on my Department of Misinformation every time I read them. Because I so rapidly make up, as a matter of fact, I can hardly get to page 2 before I've left the essay and gone off and tried to make up something from the very first sections. Well, now let's go back to some history then. Some mis-history or whatever, you can find out later, because if you want to be scholars, you certainly can find out later. You can correct me, you know. Olson is 10 years or so older than I am. But what makes a generation in writing is not how old you are. This seems to be a universal misunderstanding about generation in writing, but when you write, when you begin to write, not taking a further departure back, so we're safely in a little group that you all are so familiar with in relation to literature that you can forget they were a living human being. If you go back to 1912, and you go to the ones that we call images, the pound-named images, I'm just going to try to show the little cluster here. Pound lists all of Lincoln and H.D. and himself as the ones who sat down one evening in 1912 and made a little cradle. Now, that cradle actually is in back of what we're going to come to later. How many in the room actually have read the Images Cradle and are familiar with the 3 points of the Images Cradle? Well, all right, lots of hands. How many have not read the Images Cradle and don't know the 3 points? The first of the 3 points was that they were going to composed by the musical phrase. All of these things seem so ludicrous at the time and are still attacked. You only have to read a book like Elizabeth Drew's to find the ignorance that's present in the current scene. But, all right, they were going to compose by the musical phrase. They were going to use no word that did not contribute to the meaning of the poem. And how would I get that? Well, because I think there were going to be meaning centered as far as the use of words goes. What is it? Meaning? And the third thing is that they were going to treat direct treatment of the thing they called the image. All of these things had room for misunderstanding at the time. This was criticized because they said there's no connection between music and poetry, or Mr. Pound must have just been making up a connection. But Pound, that objection is always made by people who are ignorant of Pound's work, actually, because back of that musical phrase is Pound's papers on music, in which he explains that poetry and music are both time arts. That is, they extend in time, and they are different in that way from painting and sculpture. Later in this period, by the time you come to the to the people who are studying arts, scholars of form, in the 30s and 40s, they are already, or also psychologists, are already beginning to break down and discover that our eyes have composed a painting in order to see it, and so that there's a way of making a painting into a time art. But the artist can't govern what that path is going to be. In other words, it does take, a painting has to take place in time because the painter literally does. I mean, it takes him a duration of time to compose the canvas, and the eye of seeing it, if it does see it and not just take it at the level of an advertisement, also has to take time and move over that surface, so it does, it has extension. But you see that music and language were literally time art. Unless you can keep an image, the thing in poetry, the misleading thing was, of course, everybody thought they could read. Well, that's a very unfortunate thing. Reading should not be taught after the second grade, and those who aren't interested in reading would forget it, and the rest of them would know they haven't been taught to read, or that reading is not the same as... Because the one who thought they could have been taught to read looked at this notation and thought, no, that's not notation, that's things on a page, and that's the poem. And that's all those people at the level that say a poem begins with capital letters, and it all begins at this margin, and it has you know, certain sounds at the end or dozens that sound the same, and it's in lines, not in prose. But this business of the poem being some shape like this was a visual idea that didn't even exist. It would be like picking up a sheet of music and saying, music, that sound I hear can't be music, because music's dots on a page in a certain... It goes up like this and down like that, and has little spaces in between. The other thing that was really a sticker at this time was this idea of image. And immediately you began to get something, I don't know, if you've sampled through, and this anthology, for instance, is based, it's the only anthology I know of after the... adventurous in a way, after the objectivist anthologies of the 30s, that stands for a group in the sense that all of this anthology was not composed by the editor's taste, but because he traced out lines. In other words, he asked all the poets who are the poets you read. And so you actually have a network that all do relate in one way or another, and so it is an historical anthology, just as the first Imagist anthology is a historical anthology. Well, within this group, the same thing, something happened by 1952 or 3, it was very clear, and then it happened before in the Imagists. A group like this drew into it, for instance, because the poetry was somewhat like at Lawrence, and that's because this image, Lawrence really was brought in by H.D. There's a real distinction between Allington and H.D. And belongs to this area because these people meant by the image something that was like, well, you've all seen this, you know, what an imago is. This image had something to do with the real world. I mean, it meant that you did not take for granted the thing you are looking at, the tree and so forth, there must be a reciprocal experience. The tree must be so immediate. Well, you know the poem of Pound, in which Pound, before 1912, before this business called Imagism, in which Pound is being a tree, so that you have the whole, but then this was what people were doing also in dance and drama at the time. And they were more than that. Not only were they doing that in dance and drama, and think of Van Gogh, where the intensity of the painting, the one that we now see divorced in abstract, but you finding the stroke is there as much as the other parts of the visual impact. In Van Gogh's stage, it was really entering into the rhythms of the trees and so forth. In that very same stage, they were just beginning to observe that what they before thought were savages, the primitive man had this kind of exchange with nature. In other words, they were learning it. They were just beginning to be able to read And they still read in very much the same terms, the civilizations that the European man was now really becoming involved with, the civilizations of Asia, of the Samoan Islands, the civilizations of Indians, the civilizations of all the conquered people. Let's say that by the 20th century, Europe had so successfully dominated and all of the other areas of the world, as Malraux says, for instance, every place that the kitsch of the Western world came into contact with the peoples of Asia or Africa or Indian cultures, the kitsch conquered. But Malraux doesn't quite observe that kitsch conquers almost all minds, for instance, the very first effect of something like Picasso is it's taken over and becomes part of our advertising world almost immediately. And that advertising world, well, the other part of the exchange, though, was that people like Picasso were beginning to draw, they were beginning to draw not only from what had been called their own tradition, but they were beginning to draw from Africa, from Asia, and from the cultures that at the end of the century were thought of as primitive. Now, we still use the term primitive, but if you look at late works in anthropology, instead of talking about primitive, they talk about ways of being men. And this is now a very current picture of what it means. In other words, by the 20s and 30s, another idea of what it's beginning to build up, not that we were on the wrong path, as long as we could be on the wrong path, by the way, Western culture on the wrong path, the Indian way will save us. You're rejecting the idea that you are one of the ways of being a man. That New York is one of the ways of being a man. They had to know a lot more about those. They had to overcome even the desirability of an Indian culture to see that all of a sudden these were civilizations in contact and exchange, not a goody-goody way that you could change over and become something else. And then in this exchange, now to go back, and because boy, that one can go on forever. In this exchange, however, the image begins to be. Now think of the images and why people oppose images. The Muslims oppose images absolutely. The Catholic Church, in the breakdown of Christendom, was uneasy about the image. Were they image worshippers? What were the saints? In the heart of Christendom, they worshipped images. And they had miracles of images, and they had a magic synthesis. In the breakdown, Catholics would die today, most of them, if you ask them if the images. They began making very careful distinctions in the period of the breakdown in the 13th century, and began to try to distinguish between the image, trying to take away the numinous quality of the image. As a matter of fact, people like Aquinas were successful in destroying Christendom because they rationalized, in other words, they drew off, they drew off from this image what it was and what it wasn't, and then of course what it wasn't is what they meant to survive, and what it was they thought belonged to heathendom, because what it was exactly like the images that the African worshipped, exactly like all the, and of course beyond that you might think there were trees and real angels. So Aquinas begins to make distinctions about what kind of an experience you're having, and finally, of course, this experience is viewed. He owns an experience, but it's viewed as a hallucination, and we begin to say this part's hallucination and this part's orthodox, and finally we come to our present. But our present period is already changing, because that is what was happening in the image with the return of this concept of what things meant, the things that are supposed to be outside you. Not the Protestant, of course, completely rejected. Their whole fight had been against this image. And the image that belongs to the world of the devil and of Catholic idolatry. So that when critics are attacking images and look carefully at what it is that they can learn about the image. But actually, then there was another group. For this group, the image is numinous, and that's why Lawrence belongs to it. And then there was Amy Lowell, for whom it was not numinous at all, but for whom it was sensory and the image was... Now, this is, you see, what has happened because the numinous has become increasingly important is that now most people think of Amy Lowell as sort of a no-good poet. But actually, what happened with Amy Lowell is simply that the thing, she did a very important thing with it. Look at her Imitations of Stravinsky, for instance. And for her, the image was an impression. And there are a whole group of people. Flint is another one. This is related to Amy Lowell. This could sometimes, in Amy Lowell, things could take on a little tinge of the old symbolism, but it actually was sort of an appreciation of things. And sensitivity is very important here, whereas here it isn't at all. Energy and dynamics is the important thing in this, and the psychological interchange. Well, this group is then the thing that went on in Imagist anthologies, although these were both combined. But this is why images, and this is the image that most people think, these things were, all of them, by the way, actually belong here. You do not have that magic numinous quality. And say, let's say Sanford is also involved in this. Now, for instance, in my generation, we already were beginning to throw these people out. Why? Simply because we were disappointed. I mean, we weren't throwing them out so much as we were in part of the numinous, and you could look all day you might find it in Amy Lowell, but it would be, you know, your private hunt. It would hardly be leading you along that road. For all those, anybody present who finds this absolutely obnoxious and would like images to be and increase their sensitivity, things, color, and sensory world, look along this line of images. Now you'll find the same thing happening in this group, because when you had in projective verse an idea of a structure of a field and a projection, you'll find much more in those. But he was dynamic, and he gave certain forms in which you could write, and also along this line, a great many disparate moods and disparate objects could be brought into a single poem. We'll get down. The task here was to make real, and as a matter of fact, they tried to focus on an immediate image, and the early canto, for instance, although you'll have lots of shifts and lots of changes, tries not to be, actually keep those rather separate, and in any section you are registering an image. Now later, Pound, of course, comes into this or of the conglomerate, and you can no longer keep that track of the canvas. But I'm thinking you open in the Odyssey, you can find where you are. You sometimes wonder why the shift is taking place, but within any area, its criterion is exactly, you get this. The numinous is thought of here then as a single experience. And Pound says that there should be direct treatment of the image. Now that's 1912. What I meant originally to explain to you about generation is that by 1915, these people had quarreled so that they were no longer cohesive at all. Although all of them can be traced as can be held in our own studies as having their root in a period someplace in here. Well, the war came in 1914, was crucial. H.D. Lawrence, all involved in a group that were pacifists and quite opposed to the war. The whole numinous experience increased there. Pound was not even opposed to the war, but if you look at Moberly, you'll find his opposition to the war suddenly is rationalist, or all the people killed for a few battered books. Now, it's very close to this, but Pound has already migrated to another group which has something to do with what's going to happen there. And this is Pound's amazing. You see, a person usually looking at it says, oh, God, he's always in a new movement or something. But it's amazing seeing the idea, there are lots of movements, seeing the idea that will lead forward, or that does lead forward, so that, or because this idea of vorticism was how to get a force from two things that had really not been together at all before, that from conflicting ideas. Now, in the same period, a philosopher, Pytest, who was going to be central down here, was developing the idea that the very different concept of the role of racial, of the role of the mind in establishing the maximum energetic relation with the world. And he said that role was to transform what looked like conflict and find a terms in which they would appear as contrast. Now, this eliminated entirely the person who, for instance, whose world fits together because there are no contrasts, and everything else that might conflict is ruled out. Because for Pytest, the dynamic is conflicting. Now, what is the conflict? Except that he pictured a universe where at every step, these conflicts in the higher order became contrast of another level. And that the philosopher brings, but he also saw the physical world as doing this. And the stage of conflict would be like the explosion of something, and the contrasts are the order which precedes the, but so the conflict is a failure to perceive order in one head. And the whole goal of the mind is not to throw out, as for instance was the goal in logic, to throw out one of those elements saying they conflict, or to find some other term in which they wouldn't conflict, but it was to hold them as contrast. This is the will begins to enter in here. And the vorticism was this. I mean, it because, now let's, I can go on thinking all night, but I've got to get something traced down here. Why? Already something is starting here. What if you see that with symbolism? Yeats is trying to put things together in vast schemes. And the theosophy of the late 19th century, the only religious movement which had absorbed evolution, Darwin's ideas. See, the crisis of evolution, of those monkey trials, for instance, and so forth, was between a sincere and outspoken Christianity, and it was against an ameliorating Christianity, which had utterly failed to cope with ideas because the implication in Darwin was that there would be a spiritual, that there was a spiritual evolution. Then the meaning of Christ and the meaning of almost everything else changes in the whole structure. Well, theosophy was an effort, actually, to have a spiritual evolutionism, and it also combined with that the mixture of those cultures. The other thing that the regular Christian churches did not do at all, as they stayed in their line of the British Episcopalian or of the Protestant sect, they were incapable of incorporating in any terms all those African idols and so forth that in the modern term we have begun to think of not as primitive or something, but as part of man's religious experience. Because exactly in this period, a thing called man's religious experience or man's spirit was beginning to return to our concept. I mean, psychoanalysis, for instance, was one of those terms in which you began. It made it possible for you to see that people in Australia weren't strange and primitive or next to monkeys, that they actually were having a spiritual experience that was as vital, well, as an Episcopalian. For instance, they kept Episcopalians in the papers, which Episcopalians don't do, you know. Oh, you had a question? No, I thought it was somebody. And the vorticism was, it was centered in sculpture. For Paul, it was centered in the ideas of the young sculptor, Goya Brzezinski, and he was trying to put together ancient Chinese sculpture, Egyptian sculpture, Greek of the archaic period, into the Western world. Now, his impulse was to say the Western world lacks vitality, and we need these things, and only when we find the secret of these things will we find the new art. But back at that young man was killed in 1914, and it's one of the changes in town. One of the things that is seeded in all the mature work of these people is that they actually saw members of their generation of these 3 years die in a war. Die in the very time when they began, because Gordon Zeska, he operates between 1911 and his death in 1914, and in 3 years, he has given something that's going to appear in poetry and appears in sculpture, because the sculpture really does, well, where the sculpture does appear is very different from Brancusi or from some of his contemporaries. The other thing, Vorticism was then conceived of as a violent bringing together of things and something resulting from it. Now, they couldn't think of any more. I mean, all you have to do is read, let's say, Malraux now, who brings a great many things together. And one of the first really great imaginations about what man's spirit is in a long time, since the beginning of the century, possibly, since James and William James and Fraser. And this period, this almost looks like a nadir when you compare, because they were barely bearing the impact. Now, Fraser's made his impact here. Fraser's golden bough begins to appear in 1900, and these people were absolutely hit by it. And they had begun, let's go back to the religious thing, they had taken over then completely what he'd made real, that is, their own European gods of the old order, the gods of the locus, of the immediate place. And they ceased to be what they were for a long time in literature, interesting decorations or traditional references that would give a literary background, and that had begun to be even actually evoked. Read Jane Harrison, Jesse Weston's Ritual to Romance. These were people not connected to these poets, but both of them refer to the fact that in classical circles, in the classical circles around Gilbert Murray, the result of Fraser was that they began to no longer read their classical texts as if they were ancient Greek. They began to form little cults in society, come into the melange of the previous theosophical groups who also had gods and worshipped gods. So that probably only Pound through Yeats would know of the other connections, and Eliot, H.D. did not, but the same thing was going on in poetry that was going on in Greek studies, because Fraser had made it real that in ancient Greece those gods were not some kind of aesthetic or some allegory or some metaphor. They were a real term of living, just as in other realms people were beginning to see that those people in the South Sea Islands and those people in Africa and those people in Australia were really living, not just a, it wasn't just that they needed to afford some correct diet and a change of life through the change of life is unfortunately appropriate for what the converters wanted to do to them. Well, we can skip some in between because we do want to get down to Olson, but I want you to see how much there is in between. But outside of this generation, and here is William. And look at early Williams, because something happens to Williams in the in-between, and he develops another kind of thing, but in the early Williams, as he appeared in the egoist, all these people appeared in the egoist, that's where we find this locus, just as we appear in a magazine called Origin, and then in Black Mountain Review in a concentrated period. And they have all their quarrels, the egoist too. After that, you have a critical reaction that sets in. And I realize that most of you now have so little idea. My whole literary life, my whole life in writing, has been during the period of this critical reaction. It had thoroughly set in by the time I was a 16 in 1935, 36. It had been preceded by the Depression years, but out of the Depression years, not only has come the killing off of 19th century socialist ideas completely, they were almost dead by 1936, they turned into those things called communism and Trotskyism and Stalinism and so forth, and you couldn't find a shred of the socialist, real socialist concerns. They're completely gone, and they had all gone to graduate school, and they were editing a thing called Partisan Review, preparing to become the faculty of NYU and Columbia, and where they are. and Kenyon, another little party who had not come from socialist ideas, but they also are part of the critical reaction from this group. Now, these people, all of a sudden, this group in large represents Jewish non-religious group. In other words, what's called free thinkers, but they remain very conscious of being Jewish. So that, for instance, Partisan Review has many, many autobiographies of what it's like to be a young Jew casting off your religion in New York and how you get from the Bronx to almost being an American in one generation. Well, this is, and it didn't have quite the pathos it had back here because there's so many Jews by this time making it without having to go through Partisan Review face. Only something happened in history that made a real, because just here, Mr. Hitler came. And this struggle to become a man and not a Jew became much greater. So many people who would never have even thought of being a Jew suddenly felt it was necessary to be one. It was almost, you should remind a person, I'm not a man, I'm a Jew, and that is also part of the crux of what's happening in this period. But then that's misleading, because Mr. Hitler didn't threaten what was here, and they also felt it was necessary to remind people that they weren't something, they weren't a man, but they were something else. And here you have the small-town Protestant mind. Now, the small-town Protestant mind of Ransom or Tate, and if you he has changed the Catholic Church, let's say high-toned is Episcopalian. It can migrate into Catholicism, but it leaves it when it changes. Why? But it does have an absolute abhorrence of the numinous tree, of the image, of image worship. It has its troubles. And so it wants to tell its story, the story you find, then a metaphysics appears, and a great deal of machinery about, and logic appears all over again. And the same business, and you find your Neil Thomas, who has to then go back to the point at which in which Aquinas destroyed Christendom. They have to go back to do it all over again because Christendom is reemerging. The scandals of the Virgin and the present Catholic Church has many aspects that are beginning to take on something like the earlier Christendom. As Dante pointed out, though, the Pope usually holds them in order from ever getting it messed up again. So that it is not.
With his no ideas of things, does he consider things meaningless?
I said it's not a change took place, but I'm writing it here about Williams and the Evilist period, and there you have the gods. Read the early after Bonifall things and so forth, and you have the same thing that he does, the same thing that these people do, and that is he begins to see just like Malraux, only the poets are much earlier than Malraux. Malraux doesn't start his work until 33 or 34, but just like Malraux, Williams, for instance, goes to do you have early poems of Williams, Sarah?
No.
Oh, he goes to the Metropolitan, and he sees those vast Assyrian rooms, and he's seeing a god that is present in New York City. It really is. It's sitting there in the Metropolitan. But he doesn't mean that it's a picture of a god or something. He means there is a god in the at the Metropolitan, and that becomes a titulary god of a poem called March. That was a crucial poem in the egoist days. So these people are exchanging all the time. As a matter of fact, William Charles Williams was considerably bolder in this theory than H.G. H.G., in order to get the presence of the numinous god, had to have a very particular scene, a locus of countryside, of wilderness, or of seashore. But this, of course, he had to go to the pagan world, the countryside, where the gods survived. And Williams was to call in 1935 his first lengthy novel, Pagany. There was, of course, there was a magazine also, Pagany, and if you read Pagany, you'll get a better picture than I, since I'm not going to give this whole evening on Williams. You will get a real crux of the conflict that Williams had in the middle period. Now, you must be somewhat, just reading him in this period, you must be somewhat aware that Williams is always exceedingly close to Pound, and exceedingly in rebellion all the time. And he objects to Europe. He makes all sorts of rejections and objections and so forth. But if you trace down the why and how Williams comes into this new phase here, and I'm going to have to erase everything on the board to get to the second phase, you'll find that he was almost like he was, but all of them were in a way. And these people had to carry on their work until another experience came that would re-release the numinous. All right, let's go back to what I said happened in 1914 and what was happening here going toward this numinous. The last on into the 20s until about 25 or 26, and then the main people who are going to carry on in their later work really have to hold on to it, and it almost disappears as the way anybody's going to be looking at their work. It was the war, and it was the return of the war that became the great releasing thing for Williams, H.G., and all to enter a new phase of the Second World War and the way in which they're involved in it. Now, in between, H.G. had combined this pagan image and search for the pagan with translating from Euripides, and so what she does in between years here of the twenties and the early 30s is that in the 20s she writes a couple of impressionist novels and tries to explore having a personal ambience in which things can happen and in which you can make it real that ancient Greece is present. Well, let's say just because it's important here, but it is present. Whitehead in his essays on education, and I don't know, I think they're early, has said the Congress of Saints is a great and august body, but it has only one place to meet, and that is in the present moment. And he's trying to make clear that there is only one place in which anything happens. And that is the place where you are, right, at the moment you are. And so you are a kind of machine of things happening. Now, this doesn't mean you're in the center at all. It is in the whole, the only thing happens to you, let's say. And otherwise, Greece isn't there, you know. And Greece is only there in your devotion. And Greece is only there in the way in which it floods your life. And for all of these people, for instance, that the quality of their work would flood their lives is extremely important. And that also divides these people off from these ones who taught in universities. For Lawrence, for H.G., for Pound, and for Williams, being passionately immersed in life was absolutely central. So that the crux, let's take Williams, because he's the least apparent, and that he was a doctor. And though he had a profession, he would be comparable to you. You might have a choice between being a doctor or being a school teacher. Well, one of the central experiences in William's life is an adulterous relationship in which he has a premonition of a heart attack. And then this grows in his mind in very many ways in the poems in the period of the 30s and so forth, and then comes into play and then several other things through statements in different ways of what it would mean. It intensifies his sense of his relation with his wife, of all of the kind of the role of the adultery as a kind of magic in marriage. I'm talking about the play that I think it's A Dream of Love, is that right? And he must, over and over again, give an account of this event. Well, look through the poetry, Mr. Ransom, or Mr. Tate, and you'll find that there is a certain, or Mr. Austin, for instance, and you'll find that there's a certain difficulty about giving any vivid description of any vital, passionate thing, because your Board of Regents or your local faculty, your local faculty is going to enjoy it in a way that's going to be very different from a reader, and your Board of Regents is at a crucial and an awfully important point going to tell you that you might go to some other place. There was a real reason. But more than that, of course, I don't mean that these people couldn't do it because they went to universities because they did not want to. I mean, this is part of their whole framework. And they developed an aesthetic and a criticism in which all of these passionate things, because it's the numinous they're afraid of, the god that might enter the scene, what if you started to speak with voices in the middle of the class hall? I don't mean the idolatry, goodness. No, what? Because these numinous descendants, you don't have control in the poem at the point of the numinous descend, and you start talking in voices, and there's someone in your class who's going to run away and say, there was a whole class that was not what we were supposed to be studying. Others will be happy. Well, now let me get to sketch Mr. Olson and see if we can refer back to these things. And because Olson poet begins with writing, well, he begins with poem in Ishmael, but he really comes in major focus with writing that projective verse. And he's a man who makes propositions and opens up along those lines, and the poetry, then when the poetry really begins to be written, it is also another series, and these propositions are not even meant to hang together. When I make a diagram of anyway, what Olson looks like on the page, and you'll see what I mean about these propositions. In other words, the poetry is free to open up all sorts of things that do not carry out what you find in the essay. As the essay, for instance, don't have to hang together or carry out. That's what he means by the universe of discourse, as if when you wrote projected verse, the next essay should illustrate that, and the poem should be a fulfillment of the first essay, and so forth. This is not at all what Olson does. By 1950 is going to be the point at which Olson writes projected verse. Now, before that, he had, it isn't fatal to go to college and so forth. He had graduated from Wesleyan, and then he had gotten his PhD at Harvard, and he was one of those chosen boys under a regime in the early 30s at Harvard that was, because of the Depression years and their idea of coping with the whole problematic, the whole idea of society, which everything was centered on, they proposed that sciences of man, they never really quite developed this, it was an experiment toward the possibility of doing away with humanities entirely and having a sciences of man so that what had formerly been literature, well, this wouldn't be, they would have a humanities program, but they would also have this is a whole other way of approaching it. And Charles was the person, the person from the from the former literature department who went into the sciences of man. Now, I've met quite a few of the men who were in that. He was the only literary person in that group. The others were in ecology. Ecology, for instance, it gives a real key to what it was that was happening and why literature suddenly disappeared and sciences of man took its place. Ecology had done away with the idea of putting plants in collections. And under Sauer, who's one of Olson's masters in a way, he met him during the Sciences of Man period at Harvard. Sauer at the University of California now sends what his whole department does and potentiality is enormously expensive. It has five men in the field at the present time. One man in the upper Amazon and one in the Central Asia. They're trying to trace in the contemporary scene where Rice and Mays and so forth came from, and they're also making descriptions of the thing called ecology. This means they do not pick a plant because you've got to watch it all the time. You've got to see what the plant does. You can no longer make a little stamp album and say, I have so-and-so, and this is different, and this one, and so forth, and then show an order of this kind, because suddenly, when they really wanted to find out a question like, where did Rice come from, all the Linnaeus in the world wouldn't tell them. As a matter of fact, Darwin just begins to open up this field, but he still proceeds pretty much like Linnaeus. He's looking for, and all the changes in evolution have had to take place along the lines of developing toward these sciences of men. Now, what had happened was that certain people took literature seriously. That is, they thought that literature, now this is, the department that does not take literature seriously is thinking that literature is a series of manners and fashions and tastes and good and bad. It goes down here, and in order to be a cultured member of the middle class, you read the right things and you have a reference to sorts of things, and you eventually learn what it is to be a cultivated and civilized man. But I've already shown you that that idea of a cultivated and civilized man was beginning to break down because they were thinking of numinous qualities in life and beginning to see, no, the African is not an uncultivated and uncivilized man. He's a man with a different civilization, and he has his ways of being human. And they fail, ours fail. They have their remarkable intensity. They had every aspect that you could find in every other part of the world, then the Indian and so forth. And the place where it's most good to all of us is ours. The fact that our museums are now the things that used to be, how odd those heathen tiny are now in the whole world of art. They're not oddities. Museum alone in Paris is the British Museum are about the only places that I know of that show them as if they were facts about strange people, you know, Eskimo twins or something like that. So literature then was taken as seriously as heathen gods, and it just ceased to be literature, of course, because these began to be poetic events, and these began to be fictions. And fictions were important in the sciences of ways of being men. Well, William James had already in his psychology at the turn of the century, when the real stuff was done, described levels and kinds of reality. And he said the responsibility of the philosopher was, he was anticipating Whitehead in a way, he didn't say to see conflicting things as contrast. But he said that for the philosophy he was looking for was fullness of life, richness of life, the fullest picture he could think of. And to have that, you had to hold a whole series of plurality of realities and deal with. Now, he found logic an extremely minimal element. It belongs to the world of opinion, and let's say opinion as the place of the greatest control. But right now, we're going to be talking about poetry, and we've been talking about the numinous and religion. William James said that religion, and that the world of Christ and the world of Lear and the world of Pickwick Papers were one. And they were the world of fictive realities. Now think of how real, if you have read Dickens and you love Dickens, everything in Dickens is. And the experience of not liking a writer at all is very much like the experience of some other man's religion. I mean, the intensity that people who are, no, the people who are not concerned, there are people who are not concerned with the, there are people who are not concerned at all with literature, after all, with novels. They don't even read them, and there are plenty of people. As a matter of fact, most people find it so difficult to cope at all with what you're faced with today, if you're concerned with religion, that they just as soon take it as convention. And so you have conventions of religion that are really beginning to lack intensity because they're really maintained in order not to. The very things that, for instance, were most intense in the 18th century, the whole age of a rational religion was not some business of convention. There was no convention. They had to invent it right off the 17th century. You look for it in the 17th century. I mean, it was a desperate need, and only the imagination did it. There was no sort of thing called logic or rationality that was going to make the world of the age of reason. They had to invent reason. They had to invent reasonable men. Go back, look, fingers, they ain't reasonable men. You lose glimmer, you can invent it, you get a hint, but you can invent it everything. You can invent a book and ball back there, you know, they were running all that stuff. But a convention came off of that then you had to not know all these things that were coming together. So Olson, in a way, is coming towards poetry simply because once he goes from here to there, he's also going to be the man who goes after getting his PhD and so forth, and got a Guggenheim to write a book on Melville. And he got the book just about written. As a matter of fact, also, he blushes up to his ears because he got a chapter printed of the book before it suddenly dawned on him that this man Melville had been a very popular and successful novelist, and he had almost finished a book called The Fight and Quail or Moby Dick or whatever, a plan for this Moby Dick. And then he happened to get from the library Shakespeare, and then he bought for himself Shakespeare, and that was a lucky thing because Charles Elton was the first one, I think, who came across the volumes of Shakespeare with their notes. And as he started putting the volumes of Shakespeare with their notes together with the, and think about what did this mean, he suddenly thought, if I were anywhere as decent as this man Melville, who absolutely gave up the possibility of all of Edward Melville didn't know that by writing Moby Dick, had you ever looked at the sales of the previous novels in number and then the sales of Moby Dick? He changed from an author who was almost ready to make it and not have to work any longer in that office because the novels had a real following, and Moby Dick sold 80 copies in his whole lifetime from there on, and he was damned as far as publishing it. Everything from there on was completely gone. He thought, but he wasn't just thinking that, because that's exciting. But Melville, after all, didn't know he was going to lose all his readers. He couldn't possibly have known that that wasn't a metamorphosis Melville meant. He suddenly discovered something so real that all of the early romances changed into. The necessity, be Shakespeare, what could be more arrogant and more on Melville's part, but this arrogance was a discovery on Olson's part. If this man Melville, who was just an honest novelist, could turn into a monster like Shakespeare and want to be and do it, and Pierre's most fantastic gesture toward doing it, if you ever see, okay, then what am I doing sitting here, figuring out these sizes of matter or something and writing a book on Melville that's going to look like everybody's book on everybody? Well, other people like Ellerman were talking along, and eventually they're going to write huge tomes on people like James Joyce, somewhat finding distastefully drinking that much. Now, if Ellerman was taking a drink, possibly a paragraph in that book would be readable. Anyway, Olson, it was not drink that meant that Melville's secret was it was Shakespeare. So you've got Melville and Shakespeare, and then something he hasn't found is a man you'll find it all through Coleman Ishmael, and you'll find it's very different from anything you're going to find in media. I didn't have this background at all. Sciences of Man also belongs to a period that you should have a contact with the immediate economic reality of any situation. So that in order to study Melville, if there were even a year in Melville, your research consisted of looking up all the shipments from all the ports in that year, and all the whalers and their actual histories, and so what can you, and also a whole study of the whaling industry. You study the whaling industry, you study all of the aspects of, say anybody went on a voyage, you began to make a great picture of what was actually immediately involved in this, and this reality is the place of the sciences of man, also comes down into Maximus, And because Maximus has documents. Now these documents, Pound had documents, but Pound's tradition of having documents are those of the person trained to write a PhD thesis on the Provençal, where you know the fact, but more than that, the man who isn't going to get it because he did this, you begin to suspect that the document itself, if it tells you something, is the thing that must be gotten into circulation, not your remark about it. You get that thing that told you, because you know that it tells more than you. And, or at least you have it there, you don't make your generalizing remarks. And you've only read previous books on the Provençal, or many books on literature still, where people give their opinions and no texts. Although, presumably, the texts have been the elimination. Now, the procedure Pound insisted on was there must be text, and then you understand what it is he's seen there. But more than that, there must be text, because then eventually sees if you bring texts together, you'll see more than you did when you were so eager, Beaver, about all those nice things you saw in the first text before you ever found another one. Before you performed about them and were eager to say, oh, now I know this, and so forth, the generality. So generalities begin to disappear and particulars become awfully important. And in Maximus, which is actually a sort of a dream or a write poem, R-I-T-E, these things are used in a different way, but Charles has Olson, and this is the thing I have it from the horse's mouth, He has one rule in that, and that is there must be an actual occurrence. But this actual occurrence, Eliot actually referred to earlier, he called it an objective plurality. And he borrowed it from surrealists and had to do with magic. If magic's greatest enemy is things just being made up, it's fantasy, it's absolutely important. If you have it in the numinous, for instance, it's important. Not that you make these distinctions that Aquinas did, this is hallucination, this is something else, but you've got to know what is there and what is there, so you have levels of meaning instead, and you've got to know that you don't just introduce something because you think it's rather nice, or colorful, or poetic, or magical. So you have an objective plurality. In order, in other words, in Maximus, to have, in a Maximus which has not appeared yet, but appeared only because Charles did find and he must have just hit the ceiling with excitement, his locus, Gloucester, which is a place upon a continent, not in a country, not in America, it's on a continent. America is one of those things, like he called the universe of discourse. It could disappear, and the continent's still there. It's a locus. It was once a locus on a continent where there was no America, and it was a locus that had a continuity that he could trace that went all the way to Mexico, of people going across that continent, and so that you could make you could actually take a map, and that's why explorers, why all of those trajectories that would lead from an Atlantic coast all the way across the continent or all the way down, they begin to open a map of the world in which Gloucester exists. Now the other thing that he found recently was a young man who raised a bull in Gloucester and used to show off tossing the bull, and then the bull killed him. But this opens up one of the most ancient areas that Charles was only waiting for of man's experience. In other words, this young man with the bull was finally gored by the bull and playing those games that we see in the pre-bull fight games, the games of creep, brings you right back to the animals of the cave. But he couldn't go back to the animals of the cave. Now, this is where, now, for instance, I go back to the animals of the cave with a thought, you know. But he could not, because his is a magic right, he could not go back to the animals of the cave until he was given the domain or the objective corruption of that actually being found. So you find, in a very odd, those of you who know Patterson, in the third book of Patterson, Williams, in this place, Williams is what I would call being impressionistic, whereas Olson is not at all. Williams, in the third book of Patterson, wants to give the idea that language is going to pieces. This is an idea, not a thing of the poem. I'm going to have to get back to Williams after this one little excursion, and then in order to get back to Olson. But I do. In the third book of Patterson, you have a page where things begin to go like this, sort of in this four pieces. Now that's not notation. There's actually no way to read it. It is about as much notation as what you would find in Cummings or what you would find in Little Pictures and Joyce and so forth, or in Patchen, for instance, which very particularly is not notation, but pictures of things. It is an impression, you know. He wants to say, oh, you say, you look at it, oh, the language is falling to pieces. And that's what it means on the page. Well, it's something that looks like that. As a matter of fact, it might have gotten its idea from that. That occurs in the Maximus canon. But if you look at this thing, you will find that it's map. I mean, it's you see, this map just means, now this is the difference. I don't mean that this is not notation for anything. This is your impression that it's falling to pieces. I wish we had this. Sir, do you have Patterson here? All right, and you'll see it, and then I can really show you. But this map, in this, any of you who have, do you have Maximus? Anybody have Maximus poems?
Yeah.
Or I can hand it around, and we might have an intermission at some point here. This odd-looking thing is an actual map and a notation, and you can take it and paste off and find Spicy Doug. In other words, the ancestor of this is Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And the ancestor of this is the transition when they wanted to show interesting. This is entirely different. This is entirely, you know, Poe and the Goldbug, but I don't remember Poe doesn't make it a diagram. And this is notation, although it is again not, this is not a vocal notation. It's still a time notation in an interesting cross line. But I hope I've gotten the difference, because it's you couldn't do anything with that. You can only have an impression from it. With this, you were supposed to do something, and in your mind, you're supposed to recognize that in order to know this, in order to even see what it is that happened there in the poem, it was necessary for him to just go up and, you know, walk out of that poem. Now, all right, I'm prepared. I see what I'm prepared to do. Now, to give you a little picture of that, we went back and I showed you about people who think that a verse or a line or a poem is all that business about a margin along here and capital letters. Writers didn't have, yeah, here it is. And the whole meaning of this page is that it's gotten impossible practically to write. There's not another level. There's not an operating level that you can use that for. Except, of course, seeing that, though the origin of this thing actually is a phrase rather. Looking at the, one of the things that is very, poets sometimes have a certain amount of charm, and the degree to which, just thinking of Fraser, once I saw that map and then suddenly caught on that that's what it was, and looking for a Fraser, and magic has a lot to do with the same age when you're going to be playing pirates and so forth, but this book is filled with pirates and explorers. And actually, Maximus is to show the continuity from the kind of excitement in mind that you have in the period, when you, it gives you a key to the genuine quality that is in the period that wants, that opens up and wants adventure and wants exploration and wants finding one a quest for something. And it's kept in Shaw. It's kept, as a matter of fact, in most of many scholars. It's the underlying thing that's in Lowe's, Rose's attitude. Not only is love for Coleridge, because we discover in the book that he also is absolutely bugged by those explorers, and we go along voyages. And we go on voyages of the soul. I hope in the course of three weeks I'll get to something about that. But I'm now thinking of the diagram that's in the Maximus poem. And what I said, you're pacing off. Well, let's see if I can do it, looking at this thing, except it's a whole town. You've got a map, and you're coordinating it, and then you go to find this place. Now, Charles goes to find the place because if he gets an intuition of the poem, he's got already at the close of this poem, you're beginning to be concerned with digging. Because he'd gone through all the documents in that damn town, and he had to start digging, and he begins to find Indian relics and so forth, and another Gloucester has to appear. It's not only bringing in the continent, it's got to be in time, and he has to play the archaeologist role to a degree. Well, he wants to find where the Wallace property is, and that's exactly what we're doing. We go 47, then we go to 90. And then there was a street, and you go 230 pages and so forth, and then you go to, and then you get Kent's property and Pierce, and then you're following this description. All of this, most of this is just fear. One of the things that this is one of the most puzzling reasons I even got this to talk about is because I only really get caught in a Maximus. This is when I can't understand a goddamn thing about it at all. And this means that in the very beginning, I really was caught. I couldn't understand what was happening in this stuff. As a matter of fact, as far as I could make out, it's hard for me to see it now because the ones that I did work on in 1953 seem so clear to me now that I don't understand how in the world, you know, I think I must have been blind, except they're only clear because I really absolutely had to force almost every idea of my own about what was going to happen in a poem out of my head and devote almost at the level of my main problem was, well, not only how you read it, you can kind of do that, but what is it that I feel? Because I felt a strength moving in these lines, and I had to analyze and find out where that strength and melody was and what it was impending towards. Poetry existed long before writing, and when writing first started in Babylonia and Ur, it was not poetry at all that they recorded, but business documents. How much grain was taken in As a matter of fact, that conversation that Charles and I had in 1946 about cities and the countryside, but I was thinking of the Bolsheviks in Moscow and the Ukraine when they requisitioned grain at the point of the revolution, and all the people who raised the food that had to feed those cities of the north became reactionary peasants or bourgeois peasants or something. But had they not requisitioned food from those peasants, and the peasants didn't want to give up the food, those cities would have starved. What did the peasants care about who was going to make an automobile or something? I mean, the food is the essential, and the food is the people who raise food are the most tyrannized and exploited. But then, because we're coming to the interesting thing, that writing began on the side of the fence of the exploiters, and it was the records of those vast grain houses in Ur, and of the merchants that began to trade, and so forth, and it's a long time before you have a poem at all. So poets really were not connected with writing from the beginning. There are two possibilities, and this is something in Greek it would be very easy to check me up on, and I tried to check myself up on and couldn't find my version any place, because I can cope with Greek a bit. But there is a stage when they write like this. Or at least there's an opportunity in the period before people have decided whether to write this way or whether to write that way, when they simply go to the end of the line and go back like this on the next line and go this way on the next line and this way on the next line. And as a matter of fact, in this period, they don't even pay any attention to words. They simply fill the number of letters and then they start back with the next letter. And the Greeks went quite some time before they divided words at all. I mean, they're just the text and the play are not this. Well, this was pro and versus. Now, no matter of fact, did not take place in the Greek world. It's one of the things that took place in writing. But and if it never was connected with poetry, something else pro and versus was. The choruses in the play went this way, and then they went that way, and then they went this way, and this led right away to a feeling of alive. Now, one of the distinctions about, let's say, imagism and then the Emilol sort of thing, between the meaning and the impressionistic use of things or something, is that one school believes that everything in form is meaningful. And so it calls this convention because it thinks that's the meaning of that. The only way I can understand men who put capital letters at the beginning of every line is that those men want to write like men wrote before. And it would be very hard to discover what was the meaning of originally starting all of those lines. But I'm trying to give a feeling of the point at which this line, this prose and verses, had a meaning. Because when you were walking this way, the great dramatic thing then was that you turned around and you almost changed characters. They do it enough. You see, no, and you turn around like this, and you can show the gentleman back here, and the next turn you're another person. Or you are crow again. Well, then the other figure, this is one we very well know. The man's got a conflict on his mind, he's facing this way. And he doesn't know it, but he's facing this way because yes. And then no, I absolutely won't. Oh yes, it's an awful good opportunity. No, I simply can't. And that's what these choruses do. And of course there was the forward and backward movement. Now once, as long as those movements were there, and as long as they were vital, and in the origins of when this pro and versus thing came up, those lines then, the lines we see, they sorted out to any kind of margin. The margins also had meaning because they were points of return. Now, the absurdity, the A, B, C, D, E, is not so absurd if there are points of return and you want to accent that. And they're not absurd at all when you come to the poetry that's like Pope's, where actually the line dramatizes this whole thing. The whole line becomes organized and dramatizes the meaning of that margin and the return to it, and the meaning of lines in couplets or trios, and does do the same thing that this prose and verses was doing. Of changing its mood. But that same period was also aware of what it was doing in paragraphs. paragraphs again, like stanzas, for instance, are particular areas, have particular areas of need. But what if we're no longer doing that? What if we're only conforming to this and we don't even know, and get into the quantities? So read Valerie on prose and verses first, and you'll find, well, I have some confusion that can be in a man who's supposed to be intelligent because he confounds completely the conventions of what prose is and the conventions of what verse is, and then he asks, but how come, let's say, Tolstoy's poetry, you know, because, and of course, poetry is a term that didn't have anything to do with that at all. It had to do with making. It had to do with making something. And the 19th century sense that there was poetry in the landscape was only felt by people who thought the landscape had a maker. And the whole real meaning of finding poetry in sunsets or poetry in certain scenes and times is that they thought the presence of the creator was there. And it's the 19th century that had this sense most intensely of a creator. And also, of course, poetry meant justice or something. It meant that you saw the design in something. You saw that it fit. And of course, for the conventional mind, poetry began to mean something else. It meant that it wasn't really to be taken seriously at all. It was sort of, that's just poetry. So there were two really conflicting views of what the concept. Or that's just mentioned that, well, sunsets were just poetry. They were not. But these were people for whom there was no maker. It wouldn't need to be, let's say, a Christian maker, because the person who saw the Darwinian maker also felt there was poetry. As a matter of fact, Darwin really has a charge of he had discovered, finally, that everything around him again was meaningful. He suddenly saw, that was his vision in evolution, was that it was that he had found order again in the universe, and that there was a meaning and something constantly coming into form. Well, I really don't have to labor this point, but this thing could always change because instead of seeing fashions then, and we're going to be talking this evening and the next two times about a particular direction, and that's why I wanted to show you something coming down here, and a particular thing that people want in their human life, and I don't want to be caught, I really do not want to be caught trying to count again for the any level sort of thing. That is, there are always going to be other kinds of poetry, people making other kinds of human life, and I'm going to be talking about one that will, I also want to forestall still another thing, and that is, I showed you the vital period for the images was 1912 to 1915. The vital period for what I'm going to be talking about is 1950 to 1953, or 4, and from there on, what it is. Well, from there on, for instance, I have not had any kind of fundamental change in my own work. Well, I begin to, I would be honored except for this is what artists tend to do. I mean, I've had all sorts of other things happen. I realized in this period, because I came in contact with Olson, with Creeley, I had not met Creeley, not until 55. But both Creeley and I, by 55, were simply verifying what we corresponded with, and I could, for instance, bring Coleridge to Creeley, and because I already seen in Creeley work that Creeley related to something I was also relating to that was different from Olson's. In other words, I could see that Coleridge would be a revelation of Creeley. Now, that's not the same thing as bringing something and having a man change. That was already there. There was something in, but he had, but because he stemmed as I had from Pound, for instance, the person in between, Zukoski, who's one of the very few people in those in between years that fills in a whole area of the Pound thing, Zukoski said, well, what's the good of Coleridge? I mean, look at Pound's list of the people you should read. But recently Creeley asked me to find out that he was reviewing the book of Edith Sitwell's on Swinburne, and she had rather carelessly said that Pound was Swinburne's best critic. Well, really didn't have his books with me and with him, and he knew that I'm just a fudge on Pound, so I was able within about half an hour to give you all the references in a letter off on Swinburne. But I ran across that list that's in the ABC Reedy of the tradition, according to Edward Pound. Now, Pound is central for my tradition. But taking Edward Pound's tradition, I shared only Marlowe, and Shakespeare and Whitman, I think, are just about it that I shared. The Frenchman, for instance, that he had are entirely different from the Frenchman that I would have in the main tradition of poetry. And one of the crucial differences would come in this business of Coleridge being central for me and not at all. Not a reference to Coleridge, as far as I know, in Pound, and there are references to Shelley in Pound. But I'm not talking about literary connections, but about lines come down. Blake, for instance, is also missing from Pound's list, because Pound, while he engaged with the numinous at this level, we're going to have to talk about something else that happened, something that changed from images. But Olson, too, would ask the question, why Coleridge?
Robert, I gather one thing that you've been saying is that when Olson went to Melville, what he decided to do was to establish the locale of the locus of Melville's work.
No, Melville is the man that he discovered himself in, and of course he's not like Melville, but he. The thing that he discovered in Melville was the constant. Melville took a step that Olson was going to take too, and that is saying, I shall find myself in Shakespeare. So consequently, Olson, who does find himself in Shakespeare, and this is a constant reference for him, is utterly puzzled when he comes to another poet, Keats, who walked day and night with Shakespeare, who hardly wrote a letter that wasn't just quotes from Shakespeare, and who carried him as entirely as his poet. But so Olson says, God, how come that man, the letters are so wonderful, how come he wrote poetry like that? because that's just off his map. I'm not pointing out that his understanding is going to be the same, nor that it was going to be Melville like. But Melville was a predecessor in the way in which he would view the meaning of Shakespeare. You see, I mean, for Melville, reading Shakespeare meant Melville thought, as the people who are in a kind of Shakespeare cult, and I certainly am in my views of Shakespeare, thought that Shakespeare was a master, teacher, that Shakespeare knew something about what life most really was, or something about the way in which to have what William James called the richest coordination of all these realities.
But what I mean is, why did he go back to the documents of Melville's day? Why did Olson go back?
Oh, he had, you see. That's a separate one. That came from the science of the man. That was part of the prose. And he was going to build the document. And the magic comes in later, and the magic enters into this idea of Shakespeare in English called, of course, and the magic's already happening at the level when I demonstrated this prose and verse. Because there's a magic when I turn around. I mean, I wasn't acting because I. But had I had the line, which I would also have had to have, and turned into something, been trans. I mean, this is the transformation for it, and then you turn and turn into, and then the words are your portrait. Now that happened in writing, of course, because when poems were recited, they wove, but the interesting thing about weaving, I can't, you know what you do in weaving, you float, the shadow forward and brings back, and you weave under, over, and there always was that forward and back movement, but they were entirely separate in their origin. The writing was not weaving when it was making its forward and back. It was one of those instincts of writing this way and filling the whole tablet without having to see time saving to go back and so forth. Although by the way, both Olson and I, for instance, constantly read the latest things on the origins of other crafts, because we think of them as not just as crafts, but as arts, and as discoveries about forms, so that it is very interesting, too, that the first forms that appear on pottery and on clay tablets are borrowed from me. now. They play, the pops come before the weaving, but they don't have, they have this form, but they don't have their decoration. And when the decoration appears, it's first since thing, because that's the way they generally made their houses now, or they also know. They made the first pots that way before, and then they lined them with clay so that they wouldn't leak. And then discovered by accident in some way, in firing them, that this could be burned away and the clay would remain. They know that because for a long time they didn't figure out how to make pot. They still went through this business of making and weaving and building the clay around it. And then this was already a design element, and this was one of the design elements that they cut. And those little cuts and so forth, as you'll see in Sumerian, have real relation to these forms that were discovered as made objects of weaving. All I really wanted to give here was the writing itself is every time you are in the quandary, let's say, of the pencil or of the active writing. We are now so schooled as poets, we must all be thought of as writers. It takes now a breakdown at some level to have a poetry that weaves, not that can be recited, but that can be made up. To fit some occasion and built up. Let's get back though. I'm getting my computer. It's 10:30. Let's have a relaxing bit for any of you to ask questions, and I will give you when I start again, which will be your game for going for some time, I choose. But when I start again, as far as taking up from where I was and talking forward, will be about half an hour maybe from now, and then I will be going back to this period of origin and trying to describe to you what this impact of Olson was at that time, and also talking about the left-hand margins, the first thing you see that's different in the poems when they appear. And for instance, I've never made use of those left-hand margins, but you will see why. Because now, let's just throw it over to questions. Or anything. And I think I'll start now to give the picture of Maximus, and that will leave you with a puzzle enough by the end of the evening without even, no history from here on, maybe. The reason that digging took place is in part to feed the poem, yes. Yeats, if you remember, said that he took to the seance table because he was looking for images for poetry. And all of those people who feel that the back of poetry is some kind of reality are, in a sense, digging or trying to find the particulars that are going to give it. And they're all going to have a very great disagreement with the people who talk about poems, as if poems existed and could be judged as interesting and witty, well-made, or otherwise items all of themselves. Because for this other kind of bird, and I'm that kind of bird, a poem is part of, and no more than that, and all of that, it is part of the acts of poetry, and the acts of poetry are not only what you're going to make, but as you perform the acts of poetry, you become more and more conscious, and because you're looking for it all the time and searching it out in every possible direction, as for instance you must be aware I searched it out in Darwin, and you more and more believe that the world is a process of making. That what you keyed on to, what you brought the goddamn poem as good or bad or something, and the Bible does have one beautiful little hint about how to find the numinous world, and God said it was good. And picky little people have been going on ever since thinking they were someplace by saying, well, I don't like the taste of it, and it seems sort of bad, or maybe that's better, and this is good, and this may be gooder, and if I could have a little anthology having nice poems over here and the impolite ones here, and this is not at all what, there are some pretty terrible things that are included under good. And the Bible, if you were just take a moral attitude, you'd get awfully confused. And that good meant something that's always held in the world of the Newman, and that is that the goods, the things that fed life, were everything. And you do find, for instance, one of the best, one of
magic keys that was in Christianity was in the passion on the cross, because that was one of the great central goods of the reality of Christ. And you discovered, of course, I know he's usually portrayed today by beatniks as being sort of a victim of the lynching bee. But if you don't think that, if you think that that on the cross there was a kind of thing happening, that thing was of most good. And you discovered then, and Christians could have a feeling in suffering that there was a good, and that good led them to value experience. So that you have Dewey, for instance, who is not, where the accent is not Christian, but is still in the Christian tradition, as a pragmatist referring to undergoing and suffering something. And he almost really is not referring to what we call pleasure and pain there. It means that if you suffer, it means that you do not block off from yourself the impact of any part of it. And so that the exchange is as maximal as you can possibly make it with the event. And wherever experience, on the cross in the religion of Christianity is one of the points at which you have discovered that experience is a paramount value. Otherwise, you think that's a perfectly terrible thing that the Jews did to him, or wasn't it awful, or wouldn't it have been nicer, or did the Judas betray him or something. But if you really read further, you find out not at all. Everything cooperated for that event to take place. And then, for the poet, for instance, it's very easy to see that event as an active poem, because what happens in the poem, when it's no longer viewed as good, bad, mediocre, and indifferent, what happens in the poem are the cooperations of things to make an experience. Now,
in that connection, a few people in the chat here, they're confused about numinous.
I found that now the word that it comes from is the word numen, and I found that my idea of numen was a little confused, but mildly, because I do not share the Roman idea of numen. I thought that Newman was the place or thing where the God was, that had the presence of the God, but then